Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. We're alongside the Honorable John Facciola, retired U.S. Magistrate Judge in the United States District of the District of Columbia. We will attempt to offer information, insights, and ideas about e-discovery innovation from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit download on your iPod, iPhone, Android, whatever device you're listening to, and hit play. Today we have an interesting show highlighting the eDiscovery channel found on YouTube, which is a new eDiscovery podcast series being launched by longtime eDiscovery veterans Craig Ball and Tom O'Connor. It's interesting. We spent a lot of time preparing for this show, and most of our discussion had nothing to do with eDiscovery. We were talking more about the Marx Brothers and trivia. And I think that says a lot about both Tom and Craig. They're very interesting, and I'm looking forward to this show. Craig Ball is a frequent guest on ESI Bytes. He's been a friend for years, and anyone who's never attended a Craig Ball CLE has missed a great opportunity to both be entertained and learn about technology in a layman's terms. His format is laugh, learn, and be entertained. Craig, you can trademark that, I think, but I think it's accurate. As a former trial lawyer, Craig has followed his passion of technology and education and created some of the most widely read material on e-discovery in the industry. He's recognized by many and all, really, that know him as an expert in the field. Frequently, he's called on to be a special master in some very complex e-discovery matters. Our other guest, Tom O'Connor, has been a consultant, author, and speaker in the field of automated litigation systems and electronic discovery for the past 30 years. During that time, he's helped to shape the initiative to incorporate electronically stored information into the discovery process with his three books and hundreds of articles in national publications. His consulting experience largely involves complex litigation matters for Am Law 100 firms and Fortune 50 corporations, where he's implemented systems to acquire, process, review, share, and produce electronic documents. Tom's expertise has been recognized by federal and state courts. He has been appointed as a technical consultant on various cases dealing with large volumes of electronic evidence. Some of the prominent cases that come to mind are the BP oil spill, MDL action, known by many as Deepwater Horizon. There were also some work that he did in the Enron case. So very, very substantial experiences as well. You know, our other participant in this interesting show is co-host Judge Facciola, who's also extremely well-known in the field for his thought-provoking opinions and speaking he's done nationally in eDiscovery. And he's been a mentor to many in the field and friend to many and is active in eDiscovery education at Georgetown. So why don't we start the show here? You each have such interesting backgrounds, Craig and Tom. When did you both realize that you like talking, writing, or speaking about e-discovery topics?
Well, this is Tom. I actually really got dragged kicking and screaming into it. My background was more in complex litigation back in the DOS days. I started off doing some consulting work in the very early days for a company called Summation, which I'm sure many of you know, back when they were a DOS-based company out of San Francisco. And I actually volunteered to write an article for a periodical just out of the blue. There was, I forget, somebody had said something in an article that I disagreed with. I wrote to the editor and said I'd like to write something. She agreed, and it went downhill from there.
And may I jump in? This is Craig. You know, in introducing the show, Carl, you spoke about this program as being something that I was doing with Tom, and I want to be clear that this program that I've joined is actually it's something where Tom deserves all of the credit. It's a program that existed with our mutual dear friend, Browning Marion, who died a year ago, and an enormous loss to the eDiscovery community and all communities generally. And Tom was generous enough to ask me to step into the gigantic shoes that were vacated by Browning's death, I think only because he probably didn't know, as I didn't, that John Facciola might be available for such a role. So you got Judge Facciola, and I was the one left. So Tom was kind enough to bring me in.
Well, and let me say, that's a great point, Craig, and thanks very much. Yeah, we really have just reinvented a show. But it goes to your point about when I learned that I like to talk about this, of course, being Irish and from Boston, which is, as Judge Facciola knows, a little town just to the east of Worcester, Massachusetts. I learned to love to talk at a very early age. In the grand Irish traditions, the judge was quoting a great Irish song just before we came online. The Irish, of course, use language as a weapon, not just as a mode of communication, and I learned that at a very early age. But the show started with really a series of phone calls between Browning and myself when he was commuting on his way to work from the hills north of San Diego into his office. He had about an hour-long commute, and he would pick up the phone and call people, and we just started talking about this case and that development and whatever struck our fancy, oftentimes nothing to do with e-discovery. And at one point he suggested, you know, we're having so much fun doing this, we really got to record these things. And that was really the genesis of all of this. The only reason I never asked Judge Facciola is because I thought there was just too much foolishness involved, and Craig was far more likely to, Brownie used to say, our conversations are as much as full of mischief as they are of information, which, you know, people who know Brownie would recognize that tone immediately. So we tend to start with e-discovery and digress into whatever happens to be in front of us.
Tom, how often are you going to do the shows, and where are you going to find your guests?
The current version is up on YouTube, and there are several old of the original recordings with Browning that are also on the eDiscovery channel. It went through several iterations as it was sponsored by several different vendors over the years, and it actually had several different names. I don't even recall what they all were, and I guess I should say for the record, too, I am currently employed as a consultant by Advanced Discovery, the national company, although this particular project has nothing to do with them, so nothing I say here should be held against them.
So, Craig, you actually asked me an interesting question. You care to rephrase that at the beginning of the show?
Well, the observation was, is it such a slow summer in terms of e-discovery news that we're going to be building podcasts about upcoming podcasts?
Yeah, and we laughed and chuckled about it, but I thought it was a great question. You know, we had did a show last month that I think was a fantastic show on dark data, and it got pushed back a little bit, and I highly recommend people listening to that. And then I realized we were coming up on a tight deadline. So I acknowledge, yes, you are filler, but you're not. In a real honest, you know, way, you know, this show is about mentorship, entrepreneurship, and innovation. And I think both Tom and Craig are clearly pioneers in the field. They have been, you know, for their entire careers. They've demonstrated it on so many levels. And since we're about letting people know how to do e-discovery, how to learn about it, provide free avenues to information, this is a natural show. And much like what Browning was doing, I like talking. You know, we like talking to really interesting people too. So it's totally it could be our greatest show ever.
All the interesting people were on vacation, so thank you for having us.
I'm reminded of the young assistant United States attorney who was performing as a judge. It was a felony situation. I said, you know, Mr. Jones, I don't have felony jurisdiction, but, you know, there is authority for the proposition. I can take care of this matter on a report and recommendation. And he said, no, Your Honor, that's not necessary. We need a real judge. The young man was assigned to me for the next 30 days, and I made his life a living hell.
Nice.
I think he's selling either real estate or ice cream somewhere in Bethesda, Maryland, but I'm not sure.
Well, I wanted to add a little bit of reality to the show, and I thought it would be sort of fun as a mini preview to allow you to sort of hijack our show, which you're already doing really nicely, which is great.
Carl,
it's exactly
Carl,
what I wanted.
Carl, just a minute. Let's have a break here. I don't know about anybody else, but I just got a mountain of static that started and suddenly stopped.
Huh. No, it's fine.
Okay.
There's
good.
No static. So we're fine, I'm sure. I'll listen to
it. I think
that
was us talking, Jack.
No.
So what I wanted to do is let's talk a little bit about a topic that I found very interesting that came up a few weeks ago that we probably would have done in the older ESI Bytes when we covered anything that came through that was news. But, you know, since you can sort of take over the show, you know, it's the Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals case that just came down in Lola versus Gadden Arps that to some degree found that, you know, in a very broad general way that document review may not be considered real legal work, at least based on how both parties stipulated that a machine can do the work that reviewers can do and that the reviewers may be entitled to overtime. And I think this would be an interesting topic. I'll provide a little overview, and then maybe we can chat about it. The decision reversed and remanded the trial court's decision that document review would be the practice of law under North Carolina law, and under that original holding that because the attorneys were professionals and practicing law, they weren't going to be entitled to overtime, and there's an exemption that's involved there. But because both parties agreed in oral arguments that the work being performed by the contract attorneys was the sort that machines could perform the tasks and that the reviewers were working under such tight constraints they were exercising no legal judgment, the court found a key strand from other cases analyzing whether a lawyer is practicing law to be whether the lawyer is actually providing at least a modicum of independent judgment. And the appellate court didn't see it, so they've remanded it back for further discussion. So that's sort of the overview. You guys want to take over the show?
Well, it's an interesting thing you raise here, Carl, because there are really two very significant cases in e-discovery that both turn on a similar idea. And I don't know how many of you remember the Pippins case from a few years back that was a case brought on behalf of audit associates for large accounting firms. And the argument was much the same of, you know, the nature of what we do isn't really discretionary. It's not really that professional. And so they're working us like crazy over 40 hours. We should be entitled to overtime like anybody else, which is it was a threat then in the accounting profession. And we're seeing it as a huge threat now in the legal profession with the idea that the people who are doing purely ministerial work with virtually no judgment or discretion are not acting as professionals on a salaried basis, but are really hourly workers. And that seemed to be the crux of the Lola case as well. I don't know if you read it the same way, Carl.
Well, I on a very broad level, I see that being, you know, a big issue there. But I'd also like to say that, you know, in my experience, having worked in the review space for much of my career, all reviews are different. And, you know, I personally have no idea what Tom Lola and the rest of the team of his reviewers were employed were doing for a year and a half, doing document review, working in excess of 40 hours a week and being paid $25 an hour. And, you know, document reviews can be structured to be mindless clicks. But they also can be an investigatory sort of front line of a case. On a small level, in every firm somewhere, there's an associate looking at a few dozen files and preparing a small production. And in my mind, that seems to be the practice of law. This is just scaled out. And these reviews can be collaborative, where lawyers working in teams reviewing documents aren't machines doing their own thing. They're actually discussing what they're finding to assist themselves and making their assessments compared with the legal instructions they have, which is not a machine task. It's a human task, and it's a professional task.
But, Carl, I'm sorry. Hmm? I beg your pardon. I'm in Germany, and there's a lag, so excuse me for talking at the same time.
Yeah. I think it's hard to generalize. I can see reviews being just clicks across the industry, but I also have seen many reviews that are very interactive, and involve privilege calls or doing depot prep work. So the scope and workflow review itself for me means it's impossible to label review just across the entire industry as just being rote and machine-like in its entirety.
In fairness to the appellate court, it's crucial that the listeners consider the procedural context of this case. This was a case that had been dismissed on summary judgment, meaning that the plaintiff wasn't even going to get the potential for a day in court, wasn't going to be permitted essentially to bring forward the evidence on their contention. And the appellate court was reversing only that summary judgment. The appellate court was by no means making a pronouncement about the nature or integrity of document review across the board. And I think that would be a rather serious misreading of this case. This is the appellate court saying, well, we can conceive of a situation where a reviewer might be so devoid of judgment that it's truly just machine work, and in that circumstance, it might be reasonable to consider whether it's purely hourly work subject to overtime. Not a determination as to the character of the work, either generally or specifically for the case. It's just saying, you know, it's plausible. We need to give the plaintiff the chance to make their case and not be dismissed summarily. I mean, Judge Faccioli, you certainly are, I think it would be fair to say you are the greatest expert on civil procedure on this call, certainly. What do you think about that analysis?
I think that's quite correct. I mean, we have to remember that what was being interpreted here are the regulations promulgated by the Department of Labor that distinguish between people who are employed in certain capacities and those who are in an administrative or management capacity, who are not employed in that sense, but are employed such that they do not gain overtime, because people in that position don't gain overtime. So here the question was whether these lawyers were functioning in an administrative capacity, and the answer, I think, is it had to be no, given the way the regulations are traditionally interpreted. I have many of Fair Labor Standards Act, and I can tell you that administrative exemption is construed very narrowly. Indeed, recently, the president spoke about further tightening those regulations, and I remember when he said that, I thought to myself, I don't know how we can get any tighter. So I think we have to look at this from that perspective. And the second thing that I think bears some important emphasis is to bear in mind the model rules of professional conduct, rules, I think it's five, in the five category, number five, and they talk about delegation responsibilities. And they talk about the necessity of the lawyer actually supervising the people who are working for him. So that's an interface we have to think about as well. Carefully, at least supposedly, under the supervision of a lawyer, and that's what the model rules require. So given the context in which the case arises, the interpretation of the Fair Labor Standards Act, we better be careful about drawing any broad deductions about it, about the practice of law.
It's a very slippery slope. A very challenging situation. Go ahead, please.
Go ahead, Greg. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
Yeah, well, but it's your turn, Tom. I'll come back to it.
Well, I'd just like to focus on something the judge just said, and I think you were about to say this slippery slope. I mean, we've got an area here where the attorneys are deciding through some sort of a stipulation or agreement what the practice of law is or what the computers could do better than the people could do. Now, I think everyone on this call would agree that there are not many attorneys who are in this country who are capable to make that decision, at least in my opinion. And therefore, aren't we, as the famous jurist once said, going where angels fear to tread by letting people make this decision? And then second of all, isn't that really the purview of the Bar Association of the individual state? I'm a little uncomfortable with attorneys coming into court, and it seems to me we should do what the judge said, which is focus on the regulation, the federal regulation, which deals with supervision and wage pay, and leave the discussion of what the practice of law is to the people whose job that really is. And it seems to me that especially if you look at some of the biggest disputes we've had over the last couple of years, the Actos case, the Biomet case, Judge Peck with the two decisions, the Rio Tinto, the most recent one, you have a history of people agreeing or stipulating or coming to some sort of a protocol agreement, and then it all falls apart. So the ability of attorneys to agree in this area, it seems to me, doesn't have a great track record.
I'd just like to add for the record that the case I was on, Global Aerospace, we did get the agreement done. So it all depends on your perspective and I guess your case. But I also wouldn't mind going where angels fear to tread, because the studies that are coming out trying to figure out, is this truly machine driven? Can the machines do this? You know, the recent work that Patrick Oot's been doing through Rediscovery Institute with Oracle and data has been really interesting from what I've been reading on it, that you have technologies winning but also not doing so well. Same technology, different result. And the only difference were the review teams that were doing it. So I don't believe we have tools that do this alone. The quality of the reviewer can make a huge difference to the tools.
Let's step back, though, and put this in the context of this decision for a moment. First, I don't believe the appellate court was expressing a view on, say, predictive coding or technology-assisted review in the context of human reviewers. I think the appellate court, in speaking of mechanized decisions, was focusing on this kind of a distinction. If you hire someone whose job it is to separate the pink paper from the white paper from the canary yellow paper, is that a judgment call that suggests that it is a professional lawyer judgment? I think the answer we would all share is, hey, that's not legal work. That's not legal judgment in any respect. But when you start having someone make calls about relevance and about privilege, I think we would likely coalesce on the idea that that is the unique practice of law that requires a specialized judgment that can be made by a lay person, but should only be made by a lay person under the close supervision and training of a licensed attorney in the jurisdiction where it's happening.
Mm-hmm. So, what if the pink paper separators were meant to indicate that somebody had flagged the documents behind them as privileged?
It doesn't
matter.
I think the point is, the pink paper may mean privilege, the yellow may mean relevant, and the white may mean non-privileged and non-relevant. That's a judgment presumably made by someone who has the training and skill and the licensure and what have you to make that judgment. But if the person following on is just looking at the color of the paper, there's no way I can fit that into something that you need a law degree and a license in order to do it. That's what I think the court was saying, is yes, Mr. Lola could have been doing work of such a mundane nature, so devoid of judgment, such as if you find the word stock option in this document, set it in this pile, where there was no judgment, it was purely reflexive behavior. And I think that's what the court was getting at, is if Mr. Lola could prove that his work were so devoid of professional judgment that he should get his day in court and not be dismissed summarily just because he happened to have a law degree and be licensed in a different state.
Right. And my point is one that Carl made at the beginning, which is that every job is different. Having had an experience in my past running a coding shop in the Texas tobacco litigation, I would say that even though we had documents that had been pre-screened before they came in, we would find a 10 to 12% error rate on those. I wouldn't want to trust a computer to say it's pink, a pink slip, therefore it must, of course, be categorized correctly as privileged. I would still want somebody to review that even as they were being broken out again. Now, that's not to say that you're not correct, Craig, that there could be some tasks that are so mundane that a computer could in fact do them. They don't require any professional judgment. But I think the slippery slope for me is I remember a quote from Monty Ahalt, who was a state court judge in Prince George's County, Maryland, in the early days of e-filing. And he said, you know, when we're going in to study a court, when you've learned how one court works, you've learned how one court works. And I think the same can be said of document reviews. You know, they're all so different. It's hard to have generalizations, and I'm leery of generalizations, I guess.
Okay, Tom, I was in Chinatown, oh, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago.
Oh, you're not going to tell the chicken story, are you? The rooster that beat you at Mahjong or something?
I know that rooster.
Yeah.
I lost to that one, too.
I know that rooster, and you are not that rooster.
You're no such rooster, Mr. Senator. Yeah.
I will tell the rooster story, not only because I am such a bird brain that I could be beaten at tic-tac-toe by a chicken, but the fact of the matter is that if you could have a room full of chickens that could divide up legal documents cheaply and more quickly merely by having a lawyer in the room, that would probably pass muster if that lawyer took the stand and said, Your Honor, I brought my full professional judgment and my constant supervision and training to those chickens. And unfortunately, that is the world we live in today, which is process is not really looked at qualitatively. It hides under these broad skirts of work product. And so as long as a lawyer is willing to say, I stand by it, under Rule 26G or otherwise, it pretty much flies. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to add to that, Craig. Craig, this is actually a really interesting point because I have seen and been involved in cases back when I was doing more expert work, which I shun today. It's just not what I want to do anymore. But, you know, where lawyers will go in and say, this was our process, this is what we do. And I will tell you, I did a white paper, sort of an internal white paper, where I surveyed 350 QC-level attorneys all over the country to say what gets broken in review and what works. And the amazing result that we found was so many of them pointed to not only the talent level in the room, but also the miscommunication between the people that knew the case and them. To the level sometimes almost no guidance was given at all. But when you get in the court and you talk about these things, when lawyers do, they tend to point to this process without having any clue at all what the process really was, not getting into the weeds. And, you know, that I just find it really ironic that
so this is a good question for the
we
judge.
Throw process out in this area.
Yeah, Judge, I mean, Judge, what do you think? If somebody came into you and said, this is our process, how deep would you peer into it to find out what level of supervision had been done?
If the representation is made that this is our process and we stand by it, under the federal rules, then the matter ends. Unless the other side can show such significant deficiencies in the result that additional inquiry is necessary. In other words, under the federal rules, and e-discovery didn't change this, in a paper universe, if you produced the answers, those were the answers. And that was that. Of course, if you had left out, if there was some glaring deficiency in what you produced, further inquiry was necessary. In my decision in Peskowitz versus Faber, I talked about that. You know, you were confronted with a situation where there were things that were inexplicable. How could it be that this one person who was sitting next door to this next guy had 2,000 fewer emails? How come one guy had all his outgoing stuff and none of his incoming? All of this led me on to the next stage of the development. But barring that, I don't think, God help us, we want to create a system where every representation by a lawyer as to the accuracy of a discovery response in itself engenders a judicial inquiry into the legitimacy of what it says. If we do that, discovery will never end. It never ends now, but it will truly never end.
I have a very different view, or somewhat different view. I agree with Judge Facciola in terms of the ability to demonstrate flaws in the process based upon the production. But where we may differ is I believe that where it's manifest or can be demonstrated that the process that is going to be pursued is one that is so clearly destined to fail that we don't have to give the dog the bite. sometimes we can just see a dog is growling and rabid, and we don't have to put our child in front of it and say, okay, every dog gets one bite.
I think that I didn't mean to quarrel with that. It's the business, for example, of the 30B6 deposition, where there are 25 topics, and you appoint the village idiot, and he sits there at the deposition and says, I don't know, and that's not my job, 215 times. Obviously, judges smell out when someone is so completely misunderstood what is required that it makes no sense to give them a right. But I am saying, in the ordinary course, I don't think we really want to start a system where the production in itself mandates judicial inquiry into its legitimacy.
Yeah,
just triggered in my mind for some reason. I always think of you, Judge Fasciola, when I see these news stories. There was a RSS feed this morning about a privilege log that was submitted in a case down here in Louisiana, the Middle District of Louisiana, that was 3,000 pages long. And I just remembered how much you like to do these sort of judicial inquiries.
I just finished in my capacity. I'm retired, but I was a special master in the matter before the court claims, and there were a privilege claim as to some 600 documents. And I mean, you'll be very proud of me. I engaged in technologically assisted review. They had an electronic paper pencil sharpener. I used it. And then went through the documents one by one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
There's another aspect of this that I think I would hope our listeners and everyone else would keep in mind. Bear in mind, right now, there is no way a judge shares this mechanical or technological function. The judge cannot, under existing procurement systems, buy, for example, a search program that will help. Now, in one instance, in the El Amin case, which Colacatelli and I did something that was considered quite unusual, and I don't know if it still is, but we got so frustrated with the exchange of Excel spreadsheets that didn't agree, we forced counsel to create a database into which all the data was input, and then use that as the basis of the decisions we wrote. But that was the extraordinary situation. In the ordinary course, the judge has no capability to do anything but use the electronic pencil chart.
So, Carl, can you bring us back to the issue not that I wasn't good, but I know you want to talk about Lola and the issue of what constitutes a review and whether lawyers must do it and whether it's the practice of law. So define the issue for us. What question do you want us all to try to answer?
Well, you know, I think we already did that to some extent before we went off track a little bit into other areas, which is fine. What I wanted to do at this point was to pretend we're not lawyers, and Tom, that's easier for you, but let's be humans, okay? You know, forget the legal side here. And
Tom's a lawyer.
Tom, you're a lawyer too. Okay, then let's all become humans here, okay? And, you know, what do we think about the treatment of attorneys being thrown in these rooms and treated machine-like? Because, you know, what underpins this case, I think, is what you were talking about, Craig, earlier on about, you know, the Pippins case and this sort of revolt of, you know, people don't like to work in sweatshops and being told to show up at a location and sit with 50 of your closest friends 50 hours a week and sounds a lot like a sewing garments. And is that what we went to law school for? I see sort of a social aspect to this. I'll tell you my view on it, but I wanted to throw that out, first of all, to Judge Fasciola, because as a judge, when you get a case, there's a legal side, but there's always got to be a social hook. You know, there's always got to be something in there that gets you focused. And like, how do I come, in my view, you know, how do you deal with a social challenge within the framework of the law? You know, do you have any views on review in this?
Yeah, I know it's deeply troubling. It's troubling in the sense that in any given year, we see attrition from large firms of the best and the brightest in astonishing numbers. And I think we learn from that is as true of every single one of my law clerks. They will gladly exchange substantive work for work that is boring, even though it pays them a heck of a lot more. So I'm not so happy about a system that uses these people, burns them up, and they can't take it anymore. I don't know what the answer is, but the plight of the contract attorney is, you know, to quote the Mercado, is not a happy one. I don't see any quick answer to it. As you mentioned, the research suggests that it's the interplay of the machine and the human being that tells the story here. So this kind of labor will be needed. But
so here,
it will do so with a devastating impact on the people who are asked to do it, who feel, as you say, I mean, if they did not go to law school and spend all that money, they might have thought, well, this is a nice little job for a paraprofessional. But after that investment and reading Holmes and Brandeis and having greater dreams than that, it's a tough thing to do. And also, the level of intensity at which it's been done, and it seems frequently unnecessary. I told a story in one of my articles of a young lawyer I knew well, was with a large firm, and we were going to go sailing, and she called me that morning and said she had to go to Houston to examine the flak space of her computer, because her boss was afraid there might be something in there that might be privileged. Now, there are maybe on the face of the earth one or two good reasons not to go sailing on the Chesapeake Bay, eat crabs, and drink beer. That's not one of them.
I don't know, Judge. If you spend a little time in the slack space, you'll find it's a delightful place.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
So I have an answer to that, because I think about this almost every day, okay? And I break it down into two areas. So first of all, there's the economics. And, you know, $25 in this case, it's never a lot, okay? Let's just be clear. And the reality is there's just a lot of data. And you know, there aren't clients that will spend the money for lots of people and spend lots of money. So it's not going to be $75, $100 an hour type of a position. But does that any reason why it has to be unprofessional? And, you know, in my experience, you know, there are lots of ways to be creative with workflows, technology, and yes, trying to find the best qualified review attorneys you can find and then create a work environment that leverages their skills. So we're talking about professionalizing the field, at least that's my view on this, instead of doing, well, this is a first pass review, and here's your second pass, because the first pass, of course, is going to have a lot of defects in it. Look at the room. You know, there's no way we can get all these people coded in the same way. So then maybe we're going to have a third pass review. That, to me, sounds like flaws in the system that makes me feel really bad for the inventory on the first line. Okay? But if you leverage technology and you take the best people to do this, you can create an interesting job with review. And, you know, it requires thinking out of the box a little bit and thinking about the challenges and all the lawyers that we have in this country. We've got more lawyers in this country than anywhere else. There's no reason not to be able to pull together the best review teams. And so, you know, but I think it's got to be a professional space to really deal with it. And then the money becomes sort of palatable, because it's comparable to other areas of law that there's just not a lot of economic opportunity in, you know. Immigration, Social Security defense. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, pro bono work. I mean, there's all sorts of work that is not done for hundreds of dollars an hour.
Well, but, you know, review work doesn't have to be awful. I'm sure there are many people who like who like the flexibility that can go with working, say, from midnight till 6, if they happen to be night people. I'm sure there are people who like being able to work 6 months and take 6 months off and travel. Look, working this is not work that most lawyers go to law school to aspire to. We all know that. But it pays, and it's probably better than waiting tables. And I think when you're working at $25 an hour after you've gone to law school to review documents, you're making a judgment that is either one that aids your lifestyle or is one of economic necessity.
So I think the key point there to me in all of this is, I forget which one of you just said it, but thinking outside the box and designing a better workflow. Let's face it, big law firms are not good at that. They know how to gather a bunch of employees together and throw them in a room and say, here's the paper or here's the computer screen, and have at it. I think it's independent companies like so much space, so much of what we do in the e-discovery space, it's companies outside the law firm environment that are going to come up with those innovative ways of handling this. And I think we need to look to them to do that. I totally agree. There are better ways to do it, but if we're looking for the big law firms to be the innovators, I would respectfully suggest we're looking in the wrong place.
But there is there not, whether from the science of industrial psychology or other ones, there is a correlation with between being bored, feeling that one's intellect is being underused, and making mistakes.
Yes.
In other words, it's not a zero-sum game.
Yes.
And I it's my own experience, personal experience. I know how my efficiency and my productivity always went down in one of these endless privilege reviews. So I had a couple of rules with my clerks and me. We gave it 4 hours a day and stopped. I didn't trust myself at the 4 hours a day of doing it.
That's so funny to hear you say that.
And yeah. Most people who have done this. So that's something that also has to be. I've never understood this big firm mentality that keeping people there to midnight and not feeding them renders them more efficient.
The last person who had that
idea was Stalin when he ran, the salt mines.
Yeah.
The prevailing zeitgeist among law firms.
We had that exact same experience when we were doing manual coding of documents in the tobacco litigation for the state of Texas.
Yeah.
And we cut them off exactly as you said, Judge. 4 hours, we would take people off direct coding, and they would go to box sorting or QC. We would rotate all the people within a shift between three or four different tasks, and nobody would ever work on document review for more than 4 hours because, as we looked at their stats, their accuracy just fell off the table after that. Absolutely fell off the table.
I want to throw one other thing out in here that I don't want us to miss, okay? And there are some people that are really good at this, and there are some people that just happen to be underemployed lawyers that, they need a paycheck, and this employs a lot of people. That to arbitrarily say it's got to be 4 hours is like saying we're not going to let people hit balls that go beyond 75 miles an hour in big league baseball or something, okay? Because there's some people that can hit a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. And I'm just sharing sort of my observation from trying to figure out what makes some people better at this than others. But there are some people that have such strong reading comprehension skills. And I don't know if it's the reading they did when they were young or the type of work they did before they became lawyers. But their brains are wired in such a way that they can do more than the average lawyer can. And that's why I say it's also a skill. We can't group everyone together. I don't want to stop the person that can do 200 docs an hour accurately at 4 hours if they've shown time and time again they're really good at it.
They can do better than that, yeah.
At what point, Carl, though, at what point does the work become sufficiently mechanical, sufficiently lacking judgment in certain iterations that the poor soul deserves to be paid overtime over 40 hours a week under the Fair Labor Standards Act? I mean, are we going to penalize people because they've come to a job with a law degree? Would you say to someone waiting tables, you have a law degree, you might give advice to the various patrons, therefore, you don't get overtime?
What I'm going to say to that is that we live in a world where there's lots of flexibility and the uberization of jobs, okay? And a lot of it is built around this notion of flexibility and people having the ability to select what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And, there are ways to do this in a way that people are basically making a choice how they want to use their time. And that's not you're a machine, you're working 50 hours a week. It's, hey, here's the work. How much of it you want to do? How do you want to schedule your time? So I don't look at it like you are absolutely required and going to get overtime for doing this type of work, because honestly, I've never been in a position where I've gotten overtime when I worked in the accounting firms, when I work in law firms. I've always looked at it like, let's make the job professional. let's give you the ability to do what you want to do, and then you decide how much of it you want to do.
That's very laudable, but what happens when others don't execute as you do, and they simply make it a Stalin-like salt mine in the judge's analogy? At what point can this become such drudgery, so devoid of judgment and professionalism, that review deserves overtime?
I give you
Doesn't
the bright line rule.
The...
And this is the question. You're putting me in a box here, and I'm Trump. I'm going to give you my answer, okay? And being an entrepreneur, I am. I don't think you'll find anyone in the staffing field that's going to, you know, talk candidly about this, but I view this as a big issue, so I'm willing to.
Carl, one of the things you want to think about is, remember, in the Fair Labor Standards Act, we're dealing with New Deal legislation, which drew a distinction on the basis of management and non-management, upon the presupposition that if you were in management, you were not entitled to overtime because you would probably be compensated in other ways. That's the standard of the Fair Labor Standards Act. It doesn't have anything to do with who's a lawyer, who's not a lawyer, or indeed the nature of the work a lawyer is asked to do. So
yeah.
Craig's point is you've got to look at it as to what Congress has required.
Yeah,
and
you're...
Mr. Lola, whether he had a law degree or not, the question was, did he have a managerial responsibility? If he did not, then as a matter of law, he's entitled to his overtime.
But in that situation, what you have is you have parties that have agreed there's an employment relationship at the get-go. So now we're going down the path of deciding, is there an exemption for overtime? If you don't get to that level of deciding employment, you're in a whole different set of analysis of degree of control over a number of factors, okay? What I want to say to answer Craig's question is I believe the minute you tell someone you have to go sit in this room to the point where they can't pick anything else that they can do and they have to dedicate their time, this is basically their only livelihood. It's very hard for them to take on other opportunities, to handle a legal practice, to do the other things their law license would let them do. At that point in time, I think it's unfair if someone's working more than 40 hours not to pay them overtime. I honestly believe that. You have asked for them to work. And at those wages, I also believe it should be overtime once you've taken the amount of control and made people commute into a space. That's my thought. That's the answer to your question.
I know, but we'd have to look at the Department of Labor regulations to see if they could admit of that interpretation.
Right.
And my recollection of them, this comes from instructing many juries in the Fair Labor Standards Act, that that was not the standard of the courts.
And interestingly, some of the statutes carve out specific exceptions that say that lawyers are not subject to this role. That was inferentially involved in the Lola case, as I recall. And, you know, Lola was saying, yeah, but I wasn't really practicing law. I just happened to have a law degree from California. What I was doing was being on a Ford assembly line. I was just tightening a bolt three quarters of the way.
So I'm interested, Carl. You said at the onset, nobody's really talking about this. How come? Why is that? Is this just
I think part of it is lawyers? I think it's such a sensitive topic.
There is an interesting aspect of this that you may have read about. I think this case was settled. But a bunch of young people mostly, were offered internships, which didn't pay at all. And one of them brought an action under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And I don't know if the case was settled. But I have now had discussions with many friends who used to have those internship programs and have decided now that it's a very tricky bit of business. We ought to bear in mind that somehow that's an internship program can be very wonderful. I have no less than three nieces and nephews who began as interns unpaid, and those grew into real good jobs. So that's a question here. The problem I have with contract attorneys, and I think why they are so dissatisfied, is the work doesn't seem to be leading to anything other than itself afterwards.
Yeah.
Unlike the intern who shows she's got the stuff and the company says, okay, really impressed us this summer, we want you in the fall at $40,000 a year. That's great. The contract attorney, the reward for doing the job well is another job as a contract attorney.
That's the end of the line, yeah.
My advice to the contract attorney in that world is become a solo practitioner. You can be a divorce lawyer and a document review attorney, because if you've got the skill set to be able to do review very well, it's just another paying gig. It's just another increment of 4 hours in time, as you were saying earlier, Tom, or six or whatever, spread out over the course of the day, or eight, you know, and you get it done, and there are ways to do this creatively and absolutely allow you to practice law at the same time.
So speaking of that, are there any companies which, in fact, utilize the technology to allow people to do the review from home, which would certainly let you do that private practice a little bit more? Instead of having to go to the office and sit in the room, couldn't we leverage technology to allow access to the database via the Internet and do review from your own computer?
That's already quite common.
Yeah, we absolutely do, and people do this today. They just don't talk about it. But yes, we do that, and it works.
That'd be a great option for somebody who is trying to pursue a private practice, a solo practice.
And that I think, that's part of the professionalization of the space. If you're good at it, it's part of the work you do along with the other work you do. And I know many solo practitioners. It's not the lifestyle. It's not the 6 months on and 6 months off. It's the 7 or 8 hours or 40 hours that week you're giving to it with the 20 hours or 15 or 5 that you have for your legal practice.
Yep.
It's a mix of work.
Yep.
That to me is more appealing, because people are not going to get real jobs off document review. It's just not the type of field that people generate a profession around within a firm. It's like a glass ceiling occurs. You're that lawyer.
Right.
So anyway, that's just my view. But
hey, did we have any other subjects? Jeez, we
No. I think we've hit. We've had a very interesting show here.
I can tell you, I have the best Fair Labor Standards case of all time, because the laborers in that case were strippers at a gentleman's club. And the argument was that they were independent contractors.
Contractors, yeah.
Because they worked for tips. And ultimately, Judge Howell concluded that they were subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. And now there's been an outbreak of lawsuits by strippers.
I'm telling you.
Why don't I ever get appointed a special master in those cases?
I was going to say, I never get the call from that law firm.
As Holmes said, the common law is never static. It's always growing and meeting new challenges.
All right. Well, I think we're getting into more dangerous topics than we've already covered here. So I think at this point, I'm going to close here and hope that all the ESI Bytes listeners give the eDiscovery channel found on YouTube a chance and add it to your list of podcasts. I want to thank Craig and Tom for joining Judge Facciola and myself today on our ESI Bytes discussion. If you have any questions about this show or other programs at ESI Bytes, feel free to email me at kas@reviewless.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnaw, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. And always, as we say here, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.